This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Joan Micklin-Silver made her first film in 1973, she was one of the only women directing. The film was made independently on a shoestring budget, but it proved she was good. The film was Hester Street. It starred Carol Kane as a newly arrived Russian-Jewish immigrant to New York's Lower East Side. Silver followed that with Between the Lines, Chilly Scenes of Winter, and Crossing Delancey. You can see her new movie, A Private Matter, this month on HBO. This movie dramatizes the abortion controversy. It's set in 1962, when abortion was illegal. It's based on the true story of Sherry Chesson Finkbein, who tried to have a medically sanctioned abortion after learning the thalidomide she'd taken as a tranquilizer would likely cause severe deformation of her baby. When she tried to spread the word about the dangers of thalidomide, the word also got out that she wanted an abortion. As a result, she lost her job as the local host of the children's show Romper Room, and she was harassed by death threats. Sissy Spacek and Aidan Quinn star. I asked Joan Micklin-Silver if she ran up against any obstacles in making a TV movie about abortion.
The obstacles that it ran into were actually before I came on board, but I know that the producers did try to or consider trying to make it for one of the networks. And I don't think the networks would have been interested in doing this. NBC had made a movie that dealt with Roe versus Wade and had lost a great deal of money from advertisers, and I think that was enough to scare them all off.
Did HBO have any qualifiers when it accepted the movie?
None that I know of. I think they wanted to have a good cast, but I imagine they want to have a good cast for just about everything that they do. They don't have the same problem. They don't have advertisers that they have to satisfy or appease or get around in order to put the movies on the air. So it does mean that they have a chance to do harder-hitting shows and perhaps shows with a little bit more depth and breadth.
How did you get in on the project?
I was just asked by HBO and by the producers. And in fact, when I was first sent it, my agent called and said that they wanted to send it to me, and I said, please don't send it, because I remember this incident perfectly. It happened in 1962. I was having my children around the same time. My children were born in 58, 60, and 63. And I was a young mother in my 20s, and it was just a terrifying incident to me, as I'm sure it was to many people. Almost everyone remembers it. They remember the pictures in Life magazine, and they remember what this young woman was subjected to. And honestly, I said, I had such an anxiety about it at the time, I don't think I want to go through it again. But then by the next day, I thought to myself, well, perhaps I should do it, just because I did have such passionate feelings about it. And they sent the script, and I was pleasantly surprised that it was such a good script. William Nicholson, an English playwright, wrote it.
Maybe I'm just a couple of years too young to have been reading the news magazines then, but I don't remember the story from its time. What really stuck in your mind? What images or what?
Well, Sherry was the teacher of Romper Room, which was an extremely popular show among very young children. And Romper Room was a franchise. There was a different Romper Room lady, as we call them then, in every city. And I was living in Cleveland at the time. Sherry was living in Phoenix, and she was the Romper Room lady in her city. So it was already associated with something that you connected with your kids to begin with, because my kids just loved the Romper Room in Cleveland. And she then was hounded and harassed and was unable to get an abortion. And I was also a young woman who knew that I wanted a certain amount of children and no more. And to see what she had to go through was a very cautionary thing.
So it kind of frightened you, like, what if?
Absolutely.
Right. You were really one of the first women directors of feature films. Now, you got started comparatively late in life for a director. You'd already, I think, raised three children.
Well, I hadn't totally raised them.
Oh,
I certainly had three children. They were past preschool years.
I see, right. And you had spent a few years teaching in a school for the mentally impaired?
A school for emotionally disturbed children.
Okay. When did you realize you wanted to direct?
After I wrote my first screenplay and saw what happened to it. I always wanted to direct, but I had had a sort of a nice, oh, one could even say a ladylike plan of, you know, writing screenplays, having them brought to the screen by all the great directors, learning from each one, and then at the perfect moment stepping out and directing my own. But that only lasted as long as it took to have one screenplay made in Hollywood. And after that, I decided that if anybody was going to ruin my things, I would ruin my things.
What was the screenplay?
It was called Limbo. I was fired from it. It was an original screenplay about three wives of POWs and MIAs in Vietnam. It was like an early anti-Vietnam piece, and I meant it to be kind of a gritty piece in which you saw these three wives of professional soldiers who'd become extremely radicalized by their experience, and it was all based on the research that I'd done. And I was replaced by another writer, and the director, Mark Robeson, who had prior to that certainly made some interesting films, saw it very differently, and he had every right to see it any way he wanted to, but it did not in any way represent what I thought the piece should be. He saw it more as a sort of, woman's movie in big quotes. It was kind of sudsy and didn't have what I felt was the force of these women. And I thought the idea of women whose husbands were professional pilots and who'd never in their lives thought about any sort of political protest and who were suddenly radicalized by this experience, that's what gripped me about it. And that was not what gripped him. And he made a different kind of a movie out of it. Interestingly, he was generous enough to invite me, a disgruntled screenwriter and a fired screenwriter at that, onto his set, which was in Florida, and to allow me to do just about anything I wanted to do, to look through the camera and to talk to anybody and to stick around. And I thought that was extremely generous of him. I don't know that I would be as generous with a screenwriter that was, you know, I had replaced. But it gave me a big chance just to see how films are put together. And I learned a lot.
Now, Hester Street, which is your first feature film,
mm-hmm.
you did that pretty independently, right?
Yes, absolutely. My husband had seen me floundering around, and I was able to get work as a screenwriter but not as a director, and he thought it was rather unfair, and he said, well, you may or you may not have talent. You certainly deserve the chance to find out. So he was and is a real estate developer and said that he would he was used to doing real estate syndications, which means raising money for projects. And he said if I could write something and keep the costs really down, he would produce it for me and raise the money to make it. So that was what we did with Hester Street.
Now, how did you feel about that? Did that make it easier or more difficult knowing that it wasn't like the impersonal industry that was producing the film? It was like your husband. Do you know what I mean? And it was his time, and the risk became a more personal risk in a way, because I believe you also used some of your family money.
Some, but I mean, we basically raised it. Except that we both felt that, you know, that we would make the movie, we'd pay back our investors, it wouldn't be a problem, and I somehow didn't go into it thinking that we were going to fail. We thought we, you know, would have at least enough success to pay people back. But as it happened, no one did wanted to release the movie. And I was in a position of thinking I had made a movie that couldn't be released and that we owed money on it. And it was pretty dreadful. But we were invited to the Cannes Film Festival, where it played very well and got wonderful reviews. And Ray sold the rights to the movie in four territories. It was England, Switzerland, I can't remember what the other ones were. And we used the money from those to open it in New York, and then it got a great rave in the New York Times, so that kind of built from there. So, in fact, everybody got paid back.
Hester Street is set on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where so many of the Eastern European and Russian immigrants came. And so you had the difficult task of making your first movie a period film, where you had to redo the street that you mm-hmm. shot it on to make it look like it was a period. You had to get costumes that looked right. The people had to have Yiddish accents and in some cases speak Yiddish as well. I mean, that really presents a lot of obstacles.
That's formidable when I think about it. But I'll tell you something. I had an awful lot of trouble by then, and there was such terrific sexism in the industry. I didn't know if I'd ever get to make another movie. And I thought, I'm going to make one that counts for my family. My family were Russian Jewish immigrants. Both my parents were just full of immigrant stories, and they're my aunts and uncles. And all, you know, I just heard them from childhood, and I wanted very much to deal with that period. And I guess I didn't think so much of how hard it was all going to be. And truly, when you do your first film, you get an awful lot of help.
If you're just joining us, my guest is director Joan Micklin-Silver, and her movies include Hester Street, Between the Lines, and Crossing Delancey. Her latest movie, A Private Matter, will premiere on HBO this Saturday night. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Director Joan Micklin-Silver is my guest. You were telling us how difficult it was to make Hester Street and how shut out you were from the movie-making industry because you were a woman. How did you get to make your second movie after Hester Street?
After Hess Street, I did have a little bit of interest. I did have some people come to me and say, all right, what do you want to make next? And by that time, I had found the material for Between the Lines, which was written by a writer named Fred Barron. It was about the alternative press in Boston, papers like The Real Paper and the Boston Phoenix. And I liked the material a lot and wanted very much to do a piece in which there were a lot of main characters. And that was not the kind of thing that anybody wanted to back me doing. I don't think these multi-character things do too well in Hollywood. And even when they're brilliantly done, say Nashville, I mean, they somehow just never, their success d'esteem, if that's the pronunciation, but they really don't seem somehow to crack the big commercial nuts. And Ray said to me, you know, I don't think you're ever going to find anybody who's going to back this film. And he said, I think we ought to take the money that we made from our share of Hester Street and make it. So we did.
Oh, so you went independent again the second time?
Yes.
Yeah, Between the Lines is a really interesting and entertaining film. And it has a cast of people who went on to become very well known and who were, I think, completely unknown then, including Lindsay Krause, Jill Eikenberry, Jeff Goldblum, John Hurd. What was it like to cast that movie?
Well, I had a wonderful casting director who helped me with it, Juliette Taylor. The nice part was...
Oh, didn't she go on to work with Woody Allen?
Oh, yeah, she's gone on to do wonderful things, and she's an excellent casting director. I think she was even working with Woody Allen at the time, as far as I know, yeah. Uh-huh. The nice part was that they were all young. They all were extremely gung-ho, and they just threw themselves into it. I remember one wonderful afternoon in Boston. We did a lot of improv working on the script, and I guess my AD came to me and said, don't have people come in for rehearsals tomorrow because they have to have a day off because of Screen Actors Guild rules and so on. And I said, oh, okay. So I announced that at the rehearsal, and I said, we can't rehearse tomorrow because of these rules. And I said, however, I will be in my hotel room tomorrow afternoon, and anybody who wants to come by is welcome to come by. So, of course, they all showed up, and we continued rehearsing. Hmm. We were just an incredibly enthusiastic group.
Right. Between the Lines, I think, was a critical success and did pretty well at the box office. It certainly played commercial theaters around the country. Was that enough to get you deeper into the industry?
Not really. The next project that came along that I wanted to do was Chilly Scenes of Winter, and I had read the novel. And then
an Ann Beattie novel.
An Ann Beattie novel, a wonderful novel. And then I read in the... I can't remember where I read it. I think it was Publishers Weekly or something like that, that the rights to it had been bought by three actors who wanted to begin their careers as producers. And I was just furious somebody had bought my book because I'd always loved that book and wanted to do it and had worked with John Hurd on Between the Lines and had thought he would be awfully good for the main character. But I knew one of the actors who had read for me once and called him and asked if they wanted to talk about getting together on it because I really wanted to write and direct it. And we got together and we did do it. And this was the first project for... what was then Triple Play, now Double Play Productions, Amy Robinson and Griffin Dunn, Mark Metcalf, who have gone on certainly to be very excellent producers.
Mm-hmm. The novel that the movie was based on is Chilly Scenes of Winter. The movie was renamed Head Over Heels. What was the story behind that?
Well, it was done for UA. And at that time, UA was sort of in a transitional period, and... there was a sort of split between the people on the East Coast who were in charge of the marketing and then the people who were in the so-called creative people who were on the West Coast. Well, the people on the West Coast loved the movie, and the people on the East Coast hated the movie. And they felt that the title Chilly Scenes of Winter suggested snow and Ingmar Bergman, and I, you know, as if that was something wrong, and would discourage people from wanting to come and see it. So we petitioned them, begged them, you know, wanted so much to retain the title, which I loved. And they said that they wouldn't release it under that title, and we didn't have a choice. They released it under the title Head Over Heels, and it barely made a little, you know, blip on the screen and was gone soon at the bottom of double features and stuff like that. And it was kind of a sad thing. But then the Classics Division of UA wanted to re-release the film, and they only had two things they wanted to do. They wanted to re-release it with the original title, Chilly Scenes of Winter, and they also asked about the ending. The ending of the film is similar to the ending of the novel in that the young man who has obsessed during the entire movie over this young woman finally does get her. And when I wrote the screenplay, I followed that line of action that was in the novel. They released the film so fast, I never really had a chance to screen it with people. But once I screened it after it had been released and failed, I screened it with for film schools and various kinds of audiences, and could see that the ending didn't work because the way the film went and the strengths of the film were such that you did not want him to get the girl. You simply wanted him to get over the obsession. So we were able to take out the last scene, which would certainly fit into what I wanted as well, and then we released it and it did much better.
Now, you're still working as a team with your husband as producer?
Well, for some time, we haven't had an opportunity to work together, but just recently we've started a small company called Silver Film, of course, and we want very much to make the sorts of films that maybe don't get made but that we'd like to see, and films which use New York talent, because I live in New York and very much interested in people who live there and the great array of talent, the big talent pool in New York.
Joan Micklin-Silver. Her new film, A Private Matter, premieres Saturday night on HBO.